content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello again, this is Randall Rickman from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. This is our first issue of the year 2019. This issue is dated January 14th, 2019. Cover story, gene editing, uterus transplants, three biological parents, the future of babies. On the cover is a photograph of a baby, and the caption on the cover says, "This boy is the first baby born in the U.S. to a mother with a transplanted uterus." We go right now to the back of the book to make sure we can include this week's interview feature, and this edition is called Six Questions. The interview subject is Adam McKay. Time says, the Oscar-winning filmmaker, on his new dark comedy about Dick Cheney and how to laugh about our leaders responsibly. First question. What made you want to make Vice your new movie about Dick Cheney? Answer. A friend had given me a book about him. Every five pages, I was like, you've got to be kidding. I was astounded by the depth of his influence and the brilliance of it, too. He got that call from George W. Bush, parenthetically asking him to be VP. If he doesn't get that call, American history goes very differently. Question. Is joking about Cheney or Donald Trump just healthy catharsis, or can it be dangerous? Answer. I think you can cover how ridiculous it is, but you have to cover the real-world side as well. That's something we sometimes lost with W. Bush and Reagan, and we're losing it with Donald Trump. He is ridiculous. There's never been a leader like him. But real things are happening. You have these leaders we make fun of, but behind them are dark consequences. Question. There's a montage in Vice that depicts the opioid epidemic, natural disasters, the refugee crisis. Are you suggesting Cheney is to blame? Answer. Oh, no. In some cases, Cheney is fairly involved, like the Syrian refugee crisis, killing action on global warming, but he's a symbol of an era where a lot of powerful messaging was put forth that government doesn't solve things. School shootings, the opioid crisis, global warming, there doesn't seem to be any even remotely serious effort to deal with these problems, which is precisely what government's for. Question. Did he become more human the more you tried to understand him? Answer. What intrigued me was that he wasn't a sociopathic monster in the beginning. There's this guy from Wyoming who's cracked wise and played football and fell in love with the state baton twirling champion. There's something very human about him in the beginning and how he wants to move forward in the world with a family. Yet somehow, that ambition, that American dream, became something much darker. Question. You satirized the W. Bush years as a writer on Saturday Night Live. Was this a return to form? Answer. Part of the goal was to break this pattern of looking at each administration as its own thing. The way we looked at it was, what is this lure of power? What does this do to a person that they turn a job for the public good into their own fire pit of power? Cheney felt like a good subject, especially because he eschews the spotlight. This guy in no way wanted a movie about his life. When you see that, you know you've got real power going on. Question. To people who know you for Anchorman and Talladega Nights, tackling the subprime mortgage crisis in The Big Short and then Dick Cheney in Vice might look like a leap. Answer. We're just responding to the times we live in. The late 90s and early 2000s felt like a great time for absurdist comedy, mocking things like an anchorman's sexism in the workplace. Then the world kept changing, and it got to a point where those movies wouldn't have made sense. Once we're done with this movie, there'll be that same question. What movie will possibly want or need right now? Question. You've been tweeting a lot about global warming. Is that a contender? Answer. I think that's the ultimate ball of reality rolling toward the horizon line, the thing that could snap everyone into a state of reality and take us out of this garbage we're caught up in. But what do you say in a movie about that? Question. You had a heart attack that you attributed to the stress of this movie. I hope you're doing better. Answer. Yeah, much better. Final question. It leads me to wonder whether you might take on a less stressful subject for your next movie. Final answer. My editor keeps joking, can't we just do a love story? He might be onto something. Interview with Adam McKay, conducted for Time by Eliza Berman. Going now to the beginning, the earlier part of the magazine, and well, we're now in the opening section called The Brief. And we come to the feature in The Brief called News Ticker. It's a sidebar feature, actually running now down the middle of the page, comprising three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, Elizabeth Warren to run for president. Senator Elizabeth Warren announced on December 31st that she would form an exploratory committee to consider running for president in 2020. The next day, she announced plans to visit Iowa, the first state to vote in the Democrats' 2020 nominating contest. Second item, Netflix blocks criticism of Saudi Arabia. Netflix removed an episode of the comedy show Patriot Act with Hasan Minhaj that was critical of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Netflix said it received a, quote, valid legal request, unquote, to comply with local cybercrime laws. The episode is still available on YouTube in Saudi Arabia and on Netflix elsewhere. Final item. Women enter Hindu shrine in protest. Two Indian women entered a Hindu shrine in the state of Kerala on January 2nd in protest over rules that said women of, quote, menstruating age, unquote, could not enter because they were, quote, unclean, unquote. That ban had been overruled by the Supreme Court in September, but women attempting to enter were barred by angry protesters. Next to that is a section called The Bulletin, where the headline is The Sticking Points in the Government Shutdown by Ryan Teague Beckwith, with reporting by Alana Abramson and Brian Bennett. Dateline, Washington. Like a New Year's hangover, the partial government shutdown that began December 22nd has lingered into 2019. A new Congress was slated to be sworn in when Democrats take control of the House of Representatives. But party leaders appear no closer to resolving a standoff with President Donald Trump over his demand for funding to build a wall on the border with Mexico. Here's what each side is looking for. And Time lists three items. Top item. Trump has asked for $5 billion to build about 200 miles of wall on the southern border. He's convinced the issue is a political winner. Quote, the intensity level with Republicans and conservatives and Trump supporters, unquote, says Matt Schlapp, chairman of the American Conservative Union, quote, is through the roof, unquote, on immigration. So the president is determined to reassure his conservative base that he is fighting hard for his signature campaign promise. Second item, House Democrats, led by Nancy Pelosi, want to block funding for a project they say is ineffective and immoral, while pinning the blame for the shutdown on the president. With polls showing that much of the public opposes the wall and blames Trump for the impasse, House Democrats plan to pass a bill to reopen the government, which would not include wall money. There's no sign the president would support it. Bottom item, the Senate Republican majority mostly wants this problem to go away. The Senate previously voted unanimously to temporarily fund the government at existing levels, and Senate Democratic boss Chuck Schumer has offered the White House $1.6 billion for border security. Now GOP Senate leader Mitch McConnell says he'll allow votes only on a deal Trump supports. The buck, in other words, stops at the Oval Office. Complete report from Ryan Teague Beckwith, Alana Abramson, and Brian Bennett. Moving ahead, and still in the brief, we're now at the section called Time With. And this time, it's Time With Maine Republican Susan Collins. Time says, Susan Collins is one of the last centrists in the Senate, by Tessa Berenson. Just off the soaring, tourist-filled rotunda of the U.S. Capitol building, down a chandeliered hallway, up a few floors and what feels like the world's tiniest elevator, in a narrow, echoing corridor, lies the hideaway of Senator Susan Collins. The private office, a perk doled out by seniority, is appointed in creams and florals and feels warm, but not exactly homey. Most of all, it's secluded. No staff, no uninvited visitors, no constituents. And it was in this hidden space in late September that the Republican from Maine weighed one of the most divisive decisions of her 21-year career in Congress, whether to vote to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court. Months later, artifacts of that episode are still visible. Two newspapers with reports on Kavanaugh's contentious confirmation hearings sit on the wooden desk. A copy of the New York Times, with an image of Kavanaugh's now infamous high school calendar on the front page, and the Washington Post from the following day, showing Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford, who accused the judge of sexual assault, testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee, both of them near tears. In those jagged weeks, Collins faced an onslaught of pressure from the left to oppose the conservative judge's nomination. There were the coat hangers, 3,000 of them mailed to her office, meant to evoke the era of back-alley abortions. Parenthetically, she donated most of them, including 400 she sent to a thrift store in Maine. There were phone calls from people threatening to slit her throat, she says, or telling her staffers they should have abortions and let them bleed out and die. There was a ricin threat and an anthrax scare. A young female staffer in Maine quit because of the constant harassment. None of it daunted Collins, who has spent decades as a pivotal swing vote in the Senate. Recalling the episode on a cold November afternoon, Collins said she was, quote, baffled, unquote, that activists thought they could threaten her into voting their way. Quote, I would never be intimidated by that, unquote, she says, sitting up straighter in her burgundy leather chair. In the end, Collins cast one of the decisive votes for Kavanaugh, announcing her decision with a speech that shredded any illusions that she was unsure about her choice. her vigorous defense of Kavanaugh, coming from one of the Senate's last remaining moderates, showed just how polarized the chamber has become in the Trump era. And it highlighted how difficult it is to be a centrist when everyone else has retreated to hyper-partisan corners. In this moment in American politics, Collins can seem like the last of her kind. Collins came to the Senate in 1997, the latest in a long tradition of moderate Maine Republicans. The other senator from Maine, when she arrived, Olympia Snow, was from a similar mold, conservative on fiscal policy and national security, but a supporter of gay rights and abortion rights. And it wasn't just Maine. 2 decades ago, there were 10 Republicans representing New England in Congress. Today, those moderate northeastern Republicans are all but extinct. As of 2019, Collins is the only one left in either chamber. Over her career, a chasm has widened between the two political parties, and Collins' own voting record tracks the shift. In 2017, Trump's first year in office, she voted along party lines 87% of the time, according to a CNN analysis, more than any other year she's been a senator. At the same time, she was also the Republican senator most likely to break ranks. Quote, "I'm very worried about that," unquote, Collins says. Quote, "The center is diminishing," unquote. It was in this environment that Collins emerged as the target of Kavanaugh's opponents. Amid the coat hangers and the threats, there was only one instance in which Collins says she was truly afraid. Late one night, Collins arrived home in the pouring rain. It was dark. The streets around her Washington townhouse were deserted, and her hands were full with her briefcase and a bag of dry cleaning. A man was waiting for her. As she approached her front door, he shone a light in her face and screamed anti-Kavanaugh screeds. Quote, "Stop harassing me," unquote, she yelled back at him, shielding herself with her bags as she fumbled with her keys. She made it inside, safe, but shaken. As Collins considered her decision on Kavanaugh, she knew that half the country would hate whatever she did. But if anything, the protesters may have had the opposite of their intended effect, making Collins dig in her heels. Quote, "It is certainly obvious to me," unquote, she says, quote, "that my life would have been a lot easier if I had voted the other way," unquote. She announced her vote to confirm Kavanaugh in a nearly hour-long speech on the Senate floor on October 5th. It was a vociferous defense of the judge and a searing indictment of a confirmation process that she said, quote, "looks more like a caricature of a gutter-level political campaign than a solemn occasion," unquote. There is more in this article, but in the interest of including more in this issue, we move on. Before we do move on, we will include a illustrated mini-article in the center of the piece. It's called Collins Quick Facts. There are 3 items. First fact, senior senator. Collins first joined the chamber in 1997. She's now the 12th longest-serving member and the most senior Republican woman. Second item, liberal target. Democratic activists have already raised more than $3 million to fund the 2020 campaign of her challenger. Final item, Trump skeptic. Collins announced in 2016 that she wouldn't vote for Trump for president, but she has rarely broken party lines since. Moving ahead, and we are now in the section called The View, and this routine feature is called The Risk Report. The headline is, what the world's leaders are resolving to do better in 2019 by Ian Bremmer. Bremmer leads the column with this statement in red. As a break from my usual column, I'd like to share these New Year's resolutions for 2019 from the luminaries of global politics. He now begins the article. Every year around this time, people dedicate themselves to self-improvement in the 12 months ahead. So, as a break from my usual column, I'd like to read the minds of the luminaries of global politics. First luminary, President Donald Trump. I resolve to win the trade war with China, which is cheating us, repeal Obamacare, build a big, beautiful border wall, cut everyone's taxes, balance the budget fairly quickly, order a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on, take no vacations, play no golf, tell everyone there was no collusion, make America great again, and lose 3 pounds, just like last year. British Prime Minister Theresa May, this year I will keep calm and carry on. Oh, who am I kidding? I resolve to take one more shot at this Brexit nonsense, and, if it doesn't work, pass this utterly thankless job to Boris Johnson or Jeremy Corbyn and see how they like it. Thank you very much. French President Emmanuel Macron, I will listen more closely to the desire of my subjects and ensure their government can provide plenty of cake when they are hungry. L'état, c'est Macron. Chinese President Xi Jinping, in 2019, I resolve to project steady confidence, keep making promises, and remain patient until Donald Trump is no longer in my path. I then resolve to proceed as before. North Korea's Kim Jong-un. In 2019, I resolve to project steady confidence, keep making promises, and remain patient until Donald Trump is no longer in my path. I then resolve to proceed as before, and to take even more selfies with world leaders. Russian President Vladimir Putin. I will guarantee Ukraine's elections in March are an event to remember, and promise to use all my discipline and inner strength to avoid laughing at what comes next in the United States and to find new ways to annoy Washington that are so inventive I surprise even myself. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro. This year, I'll show the world why my family gave me the middle name Messias. I resolve to break corruption, devour criminals, bring dignity back to the office of president, and make Brazil great again. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. I will take a deep breath and count to 50 whenever someone says something about me that I don't like, work really hard to be my best self, and to make new friends, in Russia and China mainly. Julian Assange. This year I'll be a better guest for my hosts in the Ecuadorian embassy in the UK. I will do all my dishes, clean the cat's litter box on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Saturdays, and keep digging that tunnel in the basement for the moment we all know is coming. German Chancellor Angela Merkel. I resolve to hide my increasingly obvious glee at the reality that after 2021 I won't be responsible for solving Europe's problems and healing all those self-inflicted wounds anymore. Mutti out. Special Counsel Robert Mueller. This year, you can be sure of one thing. I will, and the author has parenthetically said, redacted. And that is the entire article written by Ian Bremmer. Moving ahead, this section is called The Nation, This headline is The Power of the Permian. An oil boom in West Texas is reshaping the economy, the nation, and the world. By Justin Warland. Dateline, Midland, Texas. My view from the window seat of a small regional jet landing in Midland, Texas, is either a testament to the advances of human civilization or a sign of its impending demise, depending on your perspective. Countless oil wells, identified by their glowing red flames, dot the dark landscape. We're descending into the Permian Basin, the heart of American oil country, where the massive oil and gas boom is changing not just Texas, but also the nation and the world. This year, the region is expected to generate an average of 3.9 million barrels per day, roughly a third of total U.S. oil production, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. That's enough to make the U.S., as of late 2018, the world's largest producer of crude. The windfall has turned a nation long reliant on foreign oil into a net exporter in a few short years. Not even the plunge in oil prices in recent months, which led some companies to scale back their plans for the Permian, has stopped the enthusiasm. Analysts predict the region's output will expand in coming years, thanks to cost-reducing advances in hydraulic fracturing, better known as fracking, to release oil from shale, plus changes in U.S. export policy. By 2025, U.S. oil production is expected to equal that of Saudi Arabia and Russia combined, according to the International Energy Agency, parenthetically IEA. The power of the Permian oil and gas boom is easy to spot in the basin itself, which stretches across more than 75,000 square miles of scrubby ranch land in West Texas and New Mexico. So-called man camps, hastily constructed short-term housing for oil field workers, have sprung up everywhere, amid new luxury construction projects and shiny billboards advertising Rolexes to laborers pulling in six-figure salaries. But the impact extends far beyond the region. During the past 3 years, the boom in these parts has transformed the U.S. economy, upended the international energy industry, undermined global environmental efforts, and tilted the balance of power among Beijing, Moscow, and Washington. In places like Saudi Arabia, uncertainty over future oil profits driven by rising U.S. production contributed to a rethinking of the economy. In theory, less reliance on Saudi oil has given the U.S. more leverage in other areas, like the war in Yemen, although the Trump administration hasn't prioritized such efforts. The vast new U.S. oil reserves have provided cover for the imposition of tough sanctions against nations like Iran and Venezuela, moves that at other times might have crippled global supply. And around the world, the boom in the U.S. has inspired other countries to race to develop their own shale resources. Quote, in a shale revolution world, no country is an island, unquote, says Faith Fatih Birol, who leads the IEA. Quote, everyone will be affected, unquote. The question is how. Presidents Donald Trump and Barack Obama have championed the nation's growing oil and gas markets. Abundant new shale reserves have driven economic growth and regional job creation, while reducing costs for American consumers and manufacturers. But analysts across the political spectrum caution that the energy windfall presents profound challenges as well. Neither energy markets nor national security are simple, and they overlap in complex ways here. In the long term, the boom actually threatens to undermine bipartisan efforts to establish U.S. energy independence. It could destabilize international partnerships, make the U.S. vulnerable to trade retaliation, and raise formidable new hurdles in the ongoing effort to curb climate change. The nation's response to the opportunities and risks raised by the Permian Basin boom will shape our economic, environmental, and geopolitical prospects for generations. There's nothing quite like oil country in boom times. Across the Permian, gas stations, retail shops, and fast food restaurants advertise perks like $15 per hour pay and 401k benefits as they compete to lure workers. Bare bones motels charge hundreds of dollars a night. Local restaurants, patronized by women clutching designer handbags, charge $18 for a salad. The surge in production in the Permian came at a propitious time. In the aftermath of the 2008 recession, oil demand spiked just as drilling technology unlocked layers of rich shale. Locals are eager to tout the spoils. In Odessa, Texas, entrepreneur Toby Eoff shows me the defunct theater the city is paying to renovate to house stage productions. Next door, Eoff and his wife are building a $79 million Marriott and Conference Center. Colin Sewell, who runs a group of car dealerships in the region, points out the window of his brand new office to the lot full of Ford trucks his employees serviced that day. When I visited him in September, his sales were up 50% from 2016. Quote, "When it's good, it's awesome," unquote, Sewell says. There is more to this article as well, but again, in order to include the cover stories items, which is many different articles, we go right to the health section, where the headline is, "A Family Secret Hidden for 54 Years. My parents never told me the truth about my biological father. Then I got the results of a DNA testing kit," by Danny Shapiro. Time says Shapiro's new book, Inheritance, A Memoir of Genealogy, Paternity, and Love, will be published this month by NOPF. Danny is spelled D-A-N-I. Article is accompanied by a full-color photograph, a two-shot. The caption says, "The author with her dad, Paul Shapiro, on the beach in Bermuda, circa 1965. She discovered at age 54 that he was not her biological father." Danny Shapiro writes, "One evening in the winter of 2016, my husband mentioned that he was sending away for one of those commercial DNA testing kits. He asked if I wanted him to order me one as well. I could easily have said no. I wasn't curious about my ancestry. I knew where I came from. Eastern European Ashkenazi Jews on both my parents' sides. Instead, I said yes. Why not? It seemed like a game, like those personality tests people often take online. The results, when I received them a few months later, changed everything I had ever understood about myself. I was only half Eastern European Ashkenazi, as it turned out. A person I had never heard of was identified as a first cousin. The truth was unavoidable. My beloved father, who died in a car accident when I was 23, had not been my biological father. This discovery led me deep into a world I had known nothing about. The history, science, and psychological underpinnings of assisted reproduction. I have spent the past few years piecing together the story of how I came to be, the truth of where and who I come from, and the way in which my identity was scrupulously hidden from me. In 1961, my parents, Orthodox Jews who married later in life, were having trouble conceiving. My father was part of a large family that took seriously the commandment to be fruitful and multiply. My mother, nearing 40, was desperate to have a child. They went to the now long-defunct Ferris Institute for Parenthood near the campus of the University of Pennsylvania. There they were told that a, quote, treatment, unquote, was available to help solve my dad's infertility. A practice of the day was to mix donor sperm with the intended father's sperm in order to keep alive the possibility that the child was biologically his. There was a commonly used term for this, quote, confused artificial insemination, unquote. That's actually italicized. Confused is right. Back then, the medical establishment took great pains to allow couples to believe what they wanted about what they were doing. Couples were told to have sex before and after the procedure to further the sense that the, parenthetically often completely sterile, husband could be the father. Once a woman had become pregnant, the couple might be told that her blood levels showed she must have already been pregnant when she first came to the institute, furthering the possibility that two otherwise rational people could bury the truth from their family, their friends, and themselves. The trauma and shame surrounding infertility was intense. In 1954, a court ruled that donor insemination constituted adultery on the part of the woman, whether or not the husband had granted consent. 9 years earlier, Time ran a story about the legal status of donor-conceived children with a lacerating title, this is all caps, artificial bastards, question mark. Records were heavily coded, then destroyed. Sperm donors were guaranteed anonymity. It seemed fail-safe that the procedure would remain forever secret. The idea of a future in which DNA results would become easily accessible through a popular test would have been unimaginable. Now, advances in the field of assisted reproduction are also far beyond what could have been imagined at the time of my birth. In vitro fertilization, surrogacy, donor eggs, cryogenic technology, and the capacity to test embryos for genetic markers have allowed many more of us, straight or gay, married or single, to make families. And that's a great thing, but it isn't a simple thing. Though science has evolved at a stunning rate, the human capacity to understand and wisely use those advances has limped along. The secret that was kept from me for 54 years had practical effects that were both staggering and dangerous. I gave incorrect medical history to doctors all my life. It's one matter to have an awareness of a lack of knowledge, as many adoptees do, but another altogether not to know that you don't know. When my son was an infant, he was stricken with a rare and often fatal seizure disorder. There was a possibility it was genetic. I confidently told his pediatric neurologist that there was no family history of seizures. More difficult to quantify are the profound psychological effects of such nondisclosure and secrecy. I grew up feeling other, different from my family, in ways I didn't understand. I looked nothing like my dad and was constantly told that I didn't look Jewish. I was filled with longing, but for what, I did not know. The air in my childhood home was thick with the unsaid. I felt it, picked up on it, but had no name for it. The psychoanalyst Christopher Bolas has called this, quote, the unthought known, unquote, what we absolutely know but cannot allow ourselves to think. We find ourselves in an interesting sliver of time. Secrets surrounding identity have existed since the start of humanity. The Old Testament is threaded through with them. People lived and died without ever knowing the truth of themselves. But now, because of the potent combination of DNA testing and the internet, those secrets are tumbling out. At some point in the not-too-distant future, the very idea that such secrets of identity were ever kept will seem ludicrous. There is more to this article as well, but we move on in the interest of including more other articles in this section. Still in health, this headline is, Why I'm Glad I Didn't Have Kids, by Stephanie Zakarik. I'd always wanted babies, probably, eventually, possibly. When I graduated from college in the early 1980s, friends started having them while I remained happily unencumbered. After I married, family planning was more like having no plan, other than putting it off until later. When I reached the age when I was supposed to be desperate to be a mother, early to mid-30s, I didn't feel desperate. I only felt unsure. My sole mistake at the time, I see now, was not trusting that I'd be okay, maybe even better than okay, with or without a baby. Today, more and more women are choosing not to have children, and while the stigma hasn't completely lifted, it's not what it once was. But if the urge to have a child is at least to a degree biological, what does it say about you if you don't want one? At 57, a childless 57, I still meet young women who wonder why they don't want a baby more. Should they try to have one anyway? And if they don't have one, what will their lives be like? The issue is obviously even more fraught for women of childbearing age who are having trouble conceiving and are asking themselves how far they should go with it, how much they want it, if their partner wants it more than they do. When I was in my mid-30s, my then husband and I did try and fail to conceive a child. I'd seen other women who wanted babies so much that they almost seemed to be erasing a part of themselves with their anxiety. Though I would have welcomed a child, their yearning seemed foreign to me. My husband and I considered our options. The invasiveness of IVF troubled us, and we didn't have that kind of money anyway. So we just decided to stop focusing on having a baby, and a baby never came. In social situations around that time, when outsiders would nose into what I believe is private business, the fact that I had taken the path of least resistance gave me an easy out. If anyone asked why I didn't have children, I could simply say that my husband and I had tried and failed. Not only was it the truth, but it sounded less cold than, quote, I didn't want any, unquote. And yet, even today, I rarely volunteer at how utterly happy I am with the decision I made more than 20 years ago. Because I never had a child, I don't really know how to miss the experience of having one. But I do recognize all the things that have come my way as a result of not having kids, and by extension, being a woman on my own after my marriage broke up. Not having children certainly made it less difficult to end the marriage when it became clear that my husband and I had to do so. In some ways, the baby I never had is a part of me. She has given me freedom. I began my adult life as an almost laughably unambitious journalism graduate, doing proofreading and copy editing, and whatever came my way. In fact, doing almost everything I could to avoid writing, because I figured I'd probably fail. But once I started writing freelance album reviews for $20 a pop, I couldn't be stopped. By the time I had actually launched any sort of part-time writing career, the do-or-die baby-making years were upon me. At that point, I realized now my anxiety was highest, so high that it may very well be the reason I couldn't conceive. My husband was a freelance writer. I had a full-time job as a magazine copy editor. Whatever writing I was doing was happening on the side. People knew we were broke, and still so many of them said, quote, "Let it happen. You'll figure it out all later," unquote. But what would that mean exactly when the writing I was doing was already in the margins of my life? I knew women who had babies and careers, of course. It was possible. Maybe I could be one of those superwomen, getting up early, working all day, taking care of the kid before and after daycare, continuing my writing to the hours after 10 p.m. But when I looked at this future, I felt depressed in advance. No matter how helpful my partner promised to be, I knew the bulk of the responsibility often falls to the woman. I also knew that the world didn't really need extra writers, and I could see myself being too exhausted to put in that additional labor. Who'd really miss my review of the latest REM record, REM? Another more amazing woman might have gone for it all, but I didn't feel amazing, not in that way. I had finally found the thing that I loved doing, and now I had to make room for something else, someone else, and that would supposedly make my life complete. Maybe I even knew then that the idea of completeness is dangerous. I doubt there's any such thing in a life. By choosing openness over some false idea of completeness, I've had more enriching work than I ever imagined. My job these days as a movie critic is immensely satisfying, but it's that much more so because of the freedom I have. Sometimes I go to festivals simply to cover them, and the ability to just go shouldn't be underestimated. But I've also been invited to run writing workshops and to serve on juries all over the world. I occasionally wonder if my not having children has made me open to experience in ways I might not otherwise be. That's not to suggest that women with children can't be equally open. But caring for a child demands a specific focus for years at a stretch. My runway of opportunity was a straight shot for weeks, months, and years. I could say yes to almost anything I wanted to do. Every yes meant I met a new set of people, a new set of friends, and with every yes, my world got a little bigger. I have never given life to another person, but I'm amazed and grateful daily at how much life has come my way, even so. I have friends of all ages. I've had incredible romances and some concomitant heartbreak. I've taken pleasure in watching several of my nieces and nephews start families of their own. And I'm not immune to the desire to care for other living creatures. Right after my marriage broke up, I moved to a strange new neighborhood and discovered a mini colony of feral cats in my front yard. They soon became my little outdoor family. So many accounts of lives without children, lives like mine, are met with reactions like, quote, "How sad, this is all she's got," unquote. But to paraphrase John Wayne in one of my favorite movies, Howard Hawks's Rio Bravo, that ain't all I got, it's what I got. It's so hard when you're young and most of your life is before you to make the distinction between what you think you should want and what you really do want. In my baby-making years, people would say to me, quote, if you don't have them, you'll regret it, unquote. I can't say I've ever felt anything like regret, at least in the sense that they meant. To have no regrets means we experienced everything just as we'd planned, that we made the correct decisions at every juncture. No matter what Edith Piaf tells us, no one gets through life like that. What I want to say to younger women who believe that a child-free life is an unfulfilled life is that your future self is a person you haven't met yet. Don't presume to know everything about her in advance. And don't presume that you can control every element of your life just by making choices. Because sometimes even the choices you make, by default, can bring great happiness, just not the sort you envisioned. That is the entire article by Stephanie Zakarik, and we will leave with one more attempt at that John Wayne with your reader's apologies. And John Wayne was quoted by Stephanie Zakarik as saying, that ain't all I got, it's what I got. Unquote, John Wayne. Moving ahead, and we are now in the time off section, where the headline is The Horrors of Surviving R. Kelly by Judy Berman. Someone fiercely protective of R. Kelly's reputation doesn't want you to see Surviving R. Kelly, Lifetime's docuseries about his alleged crimes against women and girls. In December, a screening was evacuated following a gun threat. According to Lifetime, an anonymous caller called someone inside the theater would begin, told someone inside the theater. I'll repeat that for clarity. According to Lifetime, an anonymous caller said someone inside the theater would begin shooting if the film continued to play. Yet the incident seemed only to embolden the survivors. Parenthetically, Kelly's ex-wife, Drea Kelly, likened it to pouring gasoline on a fire. The six-episode series airs on three consecutive nights, and Lifetime will play all the installments again in a marathon. Reports of sexual misconduct have followed the R&B star for most of a three-decade career, fueled by wholesome anthems, parenthetically, I Believe I Can Fly, as well as raunchy hits like Ignition Remix, a video that appeared to show him urinating on a teen girl, surfaced in 2002, leading to an arrest and acquittal on child porn charges as his albums continued to chart. Even a 2017 report that Kelly was holding women against their will in a, quote, sex cult, unquote, failed to end his career. Surviving R. Kelly features accusers who describe him grooming 13-year-olds, locking up girlfriends, and coercing lovers into sex with underage girls. Two harrowing episodes follow parents trying to rescue daughters they allege are with Kelly to this day. It shouldn't matter how these women and their families look or sound, but the makers of Surviving R. Kelly seem keenly aware that it will help in the court of public opinion if the accusers meet strangers' arbitrary criteria for credibility. Every survivor is poised and intelligent. They are almost all black women. racial issues suffuse this tragedy, and a team led by executive producer Dream Hampton, a respected cultural critic, dissects them in all their complexity. Most of the experts interviewed, psychologists who interpret Kelly's behavior, music journalists, activists, musicians including John Legend, are also black. This may be one community's story to tell, but surviving R. Kelly reveals how it implicates everyone who's enjoyed Kelly's music. If we can't take back our complicity in these survivors' suffering, we can at least help their fire spread. Entire article by Judy Berman. And we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. We hope you've benefited from it, and we hope that you will certainly listen next time. This, again, is your reader, Randall Rickman, from Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. That's TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. This is your loyal, dedicated reader, Randall Rickman, thanking you again for joining us and for your patience with your reader during this session of the magazine. We certainly hope you will join us for the next edition of Time.